All right. Well, I think what we'll do is get started here. Again, I hope you can all hear. If you have any problem hearing or something, please, you can hit *6 on your phone and unmute it. But we've got all the phones muted so that there's no background noise to make it difficult for others to hear. So *6 will unmute it, but we'll get to that later when there's a chance to ask some other questions. I want to welcome Larry Swedrow and thank him for doing this for us. We're very fortunate to have Larry with us this morning from St. Louis. He's a very successful author and lecturer in the field of finance. Most of you have read his books over the years, as we've encouraged you to do. Larry's got a diverse and very interesting background in economics and finance and currently is the director of research for the Buckingham Family of Financial Services. Larry, you know, the difficult thing we've all got is trying to frame a view of the long run going forward from 2009. This economic recession encompasses the whole world. It happened so quickly. It happened without precedent. You know, and everybody's sort of asking the same general question. Can capitalism remain a going concern after such huge government intervention and bailouts of firms that would otherwise have failed? And you know, is what are the economic situations and investment, you know, prudence going forward? So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you enlighten us a bit about what you think is happening out there and get us focused back on investment strategies.
Thanks, Irv. Got a lot of ground we're going to try to cover in the next 35, 40 minutes or so, trying to leave enough time for questions. Going to cover a broad scope. We could probably spend 8 hours today discussing these issues and probably still not get to all your questions. So what I'd like to begin with is to answer the question I'm probably getting the most of these days, which is why is this not likely to be the Great Depression? Why are we not likely to end up like Japan with a 20-year almost kind of recession for that whole long period? That's probably the one I'm getting the most because people sense, and rightly so, that this is the worst financial crisis we faced since the Great Depression. But before I actually get into that, I want to touch on one important thing, which is to say what this call is not about. This call is not about my economic forecast or stock market forecast. Because there, while everyone would like to believe there is such a person who can tell them what will happen, my line is there's only one person who knows what will happen, and unfortunately I don't get to speak to him and neither does anyone else on this call. There's an old line among economists, and I was a forecaster for a long time, that there are only three types of forecasters. Those who don't know where the market and the economy is going, and I include myself in that group, those who don't know they don't know, and those who know they don't know but get paid a lot of money to pretend they do. So the key then is if we don't know where the market's going, we have to understand that there's risks, and we'll touch a lot more on that. Then you want to control the only thing you can control, which are, one, the amount of risk you take, not exceeding your ability, willingness, or need to take risk, and two, control the other things you can control, like the amount of money you spend, as well as your investment costs, tax efficiency, and those things. So that's important background. So let's turn to this question about why we're not likely to be like the Great Depression in Japan. So we have some history to refer to, because obviously everyone's concerned that that is what can happen. And I certainly want to point out that that's a possibility, although I think the risks are extremely low. And let me explain why I believe that to be so. In the 1930s, when we hit that wall, we were operating, number one, on a gold standard. And that meant that the key role was you had to defend the dollar at $35 an ounce. Also, the Federal Reserve was very young in its formation, had not been in existence that long, and unfortunately, we had a bad break. There was no real Paul Volcker or Alan Greenspan or Ben Bernanke around at the time. The one really strong leader at the Fed was a guy named Benjamin Strong, and he happened to have died a year earlier. So the whole situation may have turned out different if Strong had been around. But the key thing was that every policy prescription that was taken in the 1930s was not only insufficient in magnitude, but more importantly, was actually pro-cyclical or, in fact, in the wrong direction. By that, I mean it exacerbated the problem. So just to go through a little history lesson, we hit the wall in September of 29. The Federal Reserve, number one, thinks we're in this recession because of excess speculation. So what does it do? It raises reserve requirements. It raises margin requirements. And partly in defense of the dollar, it raised interest rates, one, dampening speculation, and two, defending the dollar against capital outflows. Not exactly the prescription for success of being a counter-cyclical policy. So that's one. The federal government, on top of that, cut expenses and even raised taxes. So all of the policy prescriptions were dead wrong, and they were in the wrong direction. Now, while we could debate, whether all the policy prescriptions we're doing now are right or wrong, I think no one would argue that they are in the wrong direction. No one would argue that they are not sufficient in scale to cope with the size of the problem. So everything we're doing on the monetary side, we went very quickly to a zero interest rate policy, something that the Japanese did not do. It took them a long time in lowering interest rates. We also obviously are running huge budget deficits. While the Japanese did that, we did not in the Great Depression. They were raising taxes and cutting expenditures. And another thing that's very important to recognize is that the Federal Reserve now is helping to unfreeze these credit markets by buying up lots of security and injecting liquidity. This is really key to one of the problems in the Great Depression. It's something one of the more famous economists, John Maynard Keynes, you may have heard of. Keynes said that there's something called the liquidity trap, which prevents central bank actions from even working as effectively as they might. And without getting too technical, I want to talk about the difference between real and nominal interest rates. And people should know that the only kind of interest rates that matter are real or inflation-adjusted rates. And let me give you an example. If we have interest rates at 5%, the nominal rate, and you have inflation of 10, that means the real interest rate is negative 5%, that would be a very stimulative monetary policy, and obviously it could not last because people would have great incentive to go out and borrow goods, only paying 5% for the money. If they waited a year, it would cost them 10% more for the goods. That would be a very stimulative monetary policy. On the other hand, if you had zero inflation rate, that would be a 5% real rate of interest, which would be historically very high, about twice the average real rate for long-term bonds, and about five times the rate on treasuries over the long term, treasury bills. So that would be very contractionary monetary policy because the real cost of money would be so high and the economy would likely be sent into recession. So the problem is you can lower interest rates to zero, but if you have deflation, which is what we experienced in the Great Depression, we had sharp deflation, then even a zero interest rate policy becomes a very high real rate policy. If, let's say, you had 10% deflation, which is what we had in some years in the 30s, and you have zero interest rate, that's a 10% real rate of interest. Let's assume right now we have zero inflation. That would be as if the Fed had a 10% nominal rate today. Obviously, that would kill the economy. So Keynes said you have to take further actions because here's what happens. When you have a high nominal rate, a high real rate, people stop spending because the cost of borrowing is so great, and that's on top of all the negative impacts in the economy. So what happens is the velocity of money goes down very quickly. So what's key to understand in the money supply is the GMP equals money supply times velocity. That means how often does each dollar get spent. So, you know, Irv gets a paycheck and he goes and buys food and clothing, et cetera. Those people then replenish their inventories. Those people have to manufacture, pay wages. Say that $1 gets spent, you know, 10 times during the year. But if Irv all of a sudden slows down his spending, so he's spending less frequently, velocity might drop from 10 times to 8 times, well, then GNP would drop overnight 20%. So what the Fed has to do to counter that, and that's exactly what you're seeing now as people deleverage and start to save and out of fear and everything, the Fed must do what's called this qualitative easing. They must increase the money supply to offset the drop in velocity. And that was not done and nor understood in the 30s. And clearly that is exactly what is going on now as the Fed is pumping up the money supply at a great level. Now, that runs a risk, I will say, in the future, but not today, of inflation. So I'm going to come back and touch on that issue of is inflation inevitable. But that's an issue the Japanese did not recognize and made that mistake. They did not counter that drop in velocity. There are some other mistakes the Japanese made as well. They did not deal with the bad bank issues and kept all of the banks alive, didn't let anybody fail, partly out of their culture of full lifetime employment and, you know, et cetera. That's not happening here, and we are pumping money into the banks and recapitalizing them to help them. So just as a summary of this issue, I feel highly confident while this economy is likely to stay in recession for a while longer, maybe another quarter or two. I don't think there's any risk other than, you know, the highly, highly unlikely that we'll have anything like the Great Depression with unemployment hitting 25%. The worst forecasts you see are just slightly north of 10%. I find it highly improbable we'll see industrial production drop 35% like we did in the Great Depression. So I don't think there's much risk of a Japanese-type situation now as well. And let me add just there are some good things that people aren't focusing on because the financial media loves to report, you know, bad things because, you know, there's an old line, if it bleeds, it leads. So here's some things just to keep as perspective on why things may not be as bad as they seem. First is that we do have this massive amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus, but it does take time. It works with a lag, and we'll talk more about that later. Second, commodity prices are way down. Oil is down $100 just on gas and energy for consumers, let alone business. That's estimated to be a $250 billion tax cut, and that will work its way through the system in all kinds of ways. You know, energy is used in oil to make plastics and everything else we do. Third thing, mortgage rates are way down. So those that have the ability to refinance are refinancing. I had a friend who's saving $2,000 a month on their mortgage payment. $2,000 a year on their mortgage payment. You're also seeing, of course, with home prices much lower, buyers are being attracted, and I'm sure you know, people like my children are thrilled, basically, that housing prices have come down. They're much more able to buy because homes are more affordable, and I'll touch on that in a little bit. The Fed is buying up massive amounts of assets and growing its balance sheet, and that's helping unfreeze the credit market. Credit spreads have come down. The TED spread, which is the rate at which the banks lend to each other at three-month LIBOR, subtract that from the three-month T-bill rate, that was at well over 4% in November. It is now down right around 1%. So that's a big, big drop in the risk premiums. Municipal yields, which typically run 80 to 90% of treasuries, which had gotten to over 200% of treasuries at one point at the peak of the crisis, are now down to about 110% or so for the kind of bonds we buy, a AAA-rated product. The credit markets themselves are unfreezing. There was almost no corporate bond issuance in November and December, and now you're seeing major issues to help finance, for example, these drug company deals. Dell also issued a big offering. So we're seeing the corporate bond market come back. In fact, there was more corporate debt issued in January than in the prior January. Bank profitability in their normal business lines, meaning the credit spread or the interest spread, the cost of their borrowings versus the cost of the interest earned in their lending, is way up. And so bank profitability will be restored, even as there will be more credit losses, but they are also preserving capital by dramatically cutting dividends. But if the banks can just stay around and make it through this, and partly will be helped by the massive injections of capital by the Fed, their normal banking business is enormously profitable, and it was a good sign that Citicorp reported, even with their continued credit losses, they actually made money in January and February. And lastly, I'll touch briefly, the demographics are very good in the sense that pent-up demand is rapidly building up. Now, you can delay buying a new home for 1, 2, 3 years. You can keep driving that clunker for another year or two. But eventually, you need to buy homes and, you know, buy cars. We're now buying cars at a rate of around 9 million, and the demographic demand long-term is at least, 12, because that's how many cars gets, you know, taken off the market a year. But we were buying cars at a rate of 15, 16, 17 million a year, and this country is not shrinking in population. So eventually that demand will appear. And home starts are down under 500,000, and the long-term demographic demand is about 1.7 million. So we're getting rid of a lot of this excess capacity, and eventually the demand will be need to be met. That doesn't mean we'll turn around tomorrow. But I wanted to provide some perspective here that there is some good things happening, because everyone focuses on all the bad things, partly because their stomachs are growling. So let me come back to two other questions that I'm getting that are related to the fears of what's happening. One of them is this, Larry, with all this money being pumped into the system, why isn't inflation inevitable? The answer is it's not inevitable. And a very simple example is the Japan one. The Japanese have run the largest budget deficits in the history of the world, probably. For the last 20 years, they've run massive budget deficits. And is there anyone on this call that thinks that inflation is a problem in Japan versus deflation? They've had no inflation virtually for the last 20 years, despite these massive deficits. So that tells you that there, it is certainly not a guarantee that we're going to have inflation. Now, Japan, just as an indicator, people are worried about our size of our debt. U.S. debt to GNP is about 40%. Japan now looks like an African third world country. Its debt to GNP is 180%, I believe, and there is no inflation. The key is this. The risk of inflation is there because of all this excess money being pumped into the system to offset the drop in velocity. That's a good thing that we're doing it, because the GNP would drop much more, look like the Great Depression, if that was not happening. But the issue is, will Bernanke be quick, smart enough to remove the excess liquidity when the economy recovers? That was a mistake that Greenspan made in 2003. The economy was booming, and he did not remove the excess liquidity. He kept interest rates very low. Now, we didn't end up with goods inflation. That inflation was dampened by all the cheap imports from China and India. Instead, the inflation went into real assets like real estate and gold and those kinds of things, and stocks even. But I have faith that Bernanke will recognize the error, not repeat it, and that he will tighten monetary policy and remove that stimulus when it's necessary. But it is a risk. I cannot rule out, one, that we won't continue to have a long recession, and I can't rule out the Fed won't make that mistake again. So in building fixed income strategies, we highly recommend that for tax advantage money, the vast majority should be TIPS. I urge people to do that. For those of you who are not familiar, in my book on alternative investments, there's a whole chapter there on TIPS. And for your taxable fixed income assets, you want to stay in the intermediate term, not going too long. The next question I want to address is what I'll summarize, because I'm going to try and avoid the politics here because we could get bogged down in this, but particularly from people who are, use the word, either Republican, conservative, whatever, you're hearing these kind of paraphrase things, and I'll use one word to sum it up. Larry, isn't this time different where we've got all this wasteful spending, we've got taxes going up, we've got government interference in our capitalist system, the percentage of GNP that's government spending is going through the roof. So I'm just going to sum all of that up and say people are worried about what might be called the Europeanization of the United States. So the question is then, what does that mean for stock returns if, in fact, that's what's going to happen? And one way to address that issue is to look at the returns from various countries. We have 18 countries with 39 years of data. We just ran this. And out of the 18 countries that we have almost 40 years of data, you would then, if you believe that this is the risk, you would assume the U.S. would have among the highest stock returns because it is the most capitalist system, less interference in our economy by government, lower percentage of GNP spending by the government, and yet the U.S. ranked 15th. Now, Sweden, which I think most people would agree is the most socialist or highest amount of government intervention or whatever word you want to use, actually finished second, about 3% a year higher. Denmark was third, and even France, that icon of capitalism, finished ninth. So there is no evidence to show that stock returns are negatively correlated with government spending, government, quote, interference in the economy. And one of the reasons is it's the same mistake that people make about growth stocks versus value stocks. Markets don't price growth rates. They price risk. And the countries like Sweden and Denmark might be perceived to be riskier investments, and therefore they must provide investors with higher returns. So that may be what's happening here. The market is worried about it. It drove prices down, and now you've got higher expected returns for U.S. stocks. That risk, you know, is partly already in the prices. It doesn't tell you what future returns are going to be. Here's also an interesting bit of data. Most people on this call, I'm sure, would say if you want high returns, you need to invest in countries that have high growth rates of GNP, places like China. In fact, the evidence on 100 years of study on this shows that exactly the opposite is true. There is a negative correlation between country GNP growth rates and stock returns, meaning the lower the growth rate, the higher the stock returns are. And again, that's because markets price risk. Now, what's key is, now, the people who benefit then from rapid GNP growth are the individual consumers. Their standard of living goes up. And the same thing is true about the U.S. The capitalist system with less interference from government has delivered the highest standard of living. But that does not necessarily correlate to stock returns. So everyone on this call needs to think about separating those two issues. While standard of livings may not be as high, if you believe that, about what the administration is doing, it doesn't tell you what stock returns will be. So I'm going to end that portion of the talk now and switch into a little Q&A that I'd like to do with Irv. You ready, Irv?
Sure.
What I want to focus on here is to, one, dismiss the myth that many on this call may have, because it's a pervasive myth, that stocks are only risky if your horizon is short. Jeremy Siegel's book, Stocks for the Long Run, you know, I think convinced a lot of people that stocks are safe if your horizon is long. So many people who are, say, 65 years old think, well, I've got 25, 30 more years to live. Boy, I've got to have a lot of high equity allocation. I'll still be safe. I want to demonstrate to you, one, that stocks are risky regardless of your investment horizon, and that is actually a good thing. And number two, that bear markets are not as evil as people think they are. They're actually necessary evils. So, Irv, let's see if we can go through a series of quick questions. Question one, are stocks riskier investments than treasury bills?
Yes.
So question two then is, so why do you invest in stocks, Irv?
For I want to get a higher expected return.
Right, that's the key word. Many people say, for example, that risk and return are related. That clearly is wrong. For example, you could buy a lottery ticket that's very risky, but you don't have a high expected return. In fact, you have a negative 50% return. So the key is you invest in stocks because you have a higher expected return. But, Irv, do you always get that higher expected return?
No.
If you always got that higher return, would there be any risk?
No, not if I knew I could get it all the time.
Right, so it wouldn't matter, right? If you had a 30-year investment horizon and you knew with certainty that if you just waited 30 years, stocks would have a higher return than 30-year bonds, you'd bid up the price of stocks until they yielded the same as a 30-year bond, right?
Correct.
So it cannot be true that that if your horizon is just long enough, stocks are safe. That's utter nonsense. So now my next question, Irv, if there was no risk that stocks would underperform, would there be any risk premium? And by that I mean stocks have returned roughly 10% a year for the last 80-plus years, and T-bills about 4%. So on a compound basis, you've earned 6% a year if you stayed the course. If there was no risk and we never had these bear markets, would there be any risk premium?
No, the return on both should be the same, I would think.
Exactly. And so we got a roughly 10% return because people are scared of investing in stocks. They're, on average, we're only willing to pay 15 times earnings, okay? If they thought there was no risk, they'd bid up the price to, say, 50 times earnings, and we'd have no equity risk premium. Would you like a world, Irv, where there was no equity risk premium?
Not for the past 15 years or so, no.
No, no one likes a world where there's no equity risk premium. We like a world where we have a chance to earn those 10% returns. So my next question is this. We have experienced some pretty severe bear markets. This is the third one since 1973, so it's not unusual. Third one, that's at least a roughly 50% drop. We had 73.4 for the S&P 2000 to 2002, and the NASDAQ went down, you know, like 70% or more. But what if the worst bear markets had not been down 50%, let alone the Great Depression was down almost 90%? What if the worst bear markets were only down 15%, Irv? Would stocks be risky in that world?
No, they would not. I mean, you're getting, again, you know, you're getting some certainty about the return.
Well, but they'd still be risky
because
you could lose 15%, but it'd be a hell of a lot less risky, right?
Yeah. Yes.
All right, so the equity risk premium would drop, okay? So maybe people would have been willing to pay in that world 25 times earnings. Stocks in that world maybe would have returned 6, and you still would have earned some premium over the 4% T-bills, but not the 10. Now, I think most people would obviously not be happy with that kind of world. They like the fact that they have a chance to earn those high returns, okay? So we like the fact that they're, well, we should like the fact that stocks are risky. We need these big bear markets to create the big equity risk premium that stocks have provided over the long term if you've had the discipline to stay the course. So my question for you, Irv, the last one is this. Are bear markets good or bad?
That's a difficult question. I think it depends on who you are. I mean, if you're, you know, if you're sort of my age, they can, you know, be a bad thing because you're in a spending phase. You're not theoretically at least in an accumulation phase, if you're, you know, Brent or Thalia's age, for reference to our clients, you know, you're in an accumulation phase. You've got a long time for that, so they're good.
That's exactly right. Bear markets are bad for people who are in the withdrawal phase because they're taking money out. They can never recover again because they're spending that money. And so their portfolios can blow up very quickly. However, for younger investors, you know, it's the best thing that could have happened because they're now getting to buy at much lower prices and have high expected returns. The worst thing for a young kid coming out of college in 1990 was the bull market, because probably the first 5 or 10 years they're paying off their debts and they're not making that much money. Then they're finally a more senior executive making good money and they're starting to save it. And now the Dow is at, you know, such high levels that stock returns, because PEs were 40 or 50, that the future returns were doomed to be low, and you're having to buy at those prices. On the other hand, the best thing to happen now to somebody who's now been paying off their college debt and first is now starting to invest, this bear market is a godsend. They're able to now buy at low prices and hold on. So that tells you that it's very important, absolutely critical, to have your asset allocation right and change it, adapting to the stage your life you're in. So when you're early in the accumulation phase, you can take a lot more risk. As you approach your retirement or withdrawal phase, you need to be dampening that risk. And when you're in the withdrawal phase, you need to have it much lower. And that's really the key to successful investing. So that's important to understand. What I want to do now is convince people to separate, or that they must separate in order to be a successful investor, the economy from the stock market. And they are two entirely different animals. And I want to talk about that. So I want to give you three data points to think about. The first is this. Prior to this recession, we had undergone 11 recessions in the post-war era, average 11 months, longest 16. Most people, when I do a seminar in public, I ask them to raise their hand. I ask what they think the average was for the market during those recessions. How much did the market fall? Typical answers I get are in the 20 to 30% range. It turns out in those average recessions, the market actually went up an average of 7.5% and outperformed Treasury bills. Didn't go up in every bear market, but on average it did. So even if you could have forecasted this recession, if you had looked at the data, you would have said, boy, December 2007, we're going in a recession, I should buy, because stocks have actually gone up. Okay? Now, that would have been impossible to have predicted, I think, because the NBER, the National Bureau of Economic Research, they can't even declare a recession often till a year after it happens. They didn't declare it till last November, so 11 months later. And often they can't declare one has ended until way after. And the best example of that is the 1992 election. Irv, do you remember the slogan that Bill Clinton used over and over again that helped him win the election?
No.
It's the economy, what did he say?
Oh, stupid.
It's the economy, stupid. Well,
yeah.
He was hounding about the recession. Right after the election was over, the NBER declared that the recession had ended 2 quarters ago and the economy was booming. Now, if the public had known that at the time, none of us might have heard of Monica Lewinsky. And so the point of that story is this. Even if you have the foresight to know exactly when a recession will begin and end, it's impossible to get the stock market right because, one, none of us have that foresight. The people who officially declare it often don't know it begins until way after it begins, and they can't declare it as ended way until way after. And even if you knew when the recessions began, you in this case would have been buying stocks based on that data. Okay. The second bit of data I want to give you is this. I ask people, when the economy is booming, unemployment is under 4.3%, which is basically considered full employment, how much do you think the stock market on average goes up? Given that the average is 10%, most people say something higher, 15, 18, 20. Turns out when the economy is booming and unemployment is low, stocks have returned 2% a year or less than T-bills. On the other hand, when the unemployment rate is 6% and everyone's worried and panicking, stocks have returned 15% a year or 50% higher than their long-term returns. Third data point is this. When the consumer confidence index falls below 55, everyone, of course, thinks the only light at the end of the tunnel is not a recovery, it's the truck coming the other way. The next 12 months, stocks return 16%, or an average of 60% more than the long-term return. And the reason that happens and is quite logical, and why I'm going to try to convince you not to panic and sell, it's not a good idea, is that stocks are, in fact, a leading indicator of the economy. And, in fact, the government includes it in its leading index. And the reason is simple. When the economy gets very strong and it's booming, the market knows the Fed will take the punch bowl away, if you will, and start to tighten to prevent inflation. And the market knows that will slow the economy, and the stock market tends to do poorly when the Fed is tightening. On the other hand, when the economy is down in the dumps, they know the Fed will act. They know the central bank will act. They know the government will act. Stimulus comes in. They also know it takes time, 6, 9, 12 months for it to work its way into the system. But the stock market anticipates that and starts to rally. So the best rallies have always been right in the depths of the worst parts of the economy. And the rallies are so big that it's impossible to time them. And that gets me to the next point I want to address, which is this one. I'm getting a lot, Larry, I'm not abandoning buy and hold, but this is just so risky. There's no, and I hate this word, clarity or visibility that you hear these talking heads say, because there never is clarity. There never is visibility. There's always risk in the system. But that's the word they use. So I'll just get out until there's clarity. Well, let me tell you why you should not even think about doing that. Number one, there's a study on 100 pension plans that engaged in tactical asset allocation. There's jumping in and out, moving from stocks to bonds, raising, lowering your equity allocation, shifting to large cap or small cap because the one is safer now than the other. Now, these pension plans, of course, only hire the great money managers with great track records. They never hire people with bad track records. They hire top firms to do due diligence, firms like SEI and Russell and Goldman. So you would think if anyone could do this well, they would. Now, monkeys throwing darts instead of the pension plans, 50% of them would have beat the market randomly. The answer is zero. Not a single one of the 100 pension plans added value by their timing efforts. Every one of them would have been better off simply adhering to their, call it, let's say, a 60-40 asset allocation and rebalancing. Why anyone would think they could do better, are they smarter, have more resources, whatever, that does not seem logical conclusion to me. So again, the key is to adopt an asset allocation that you can live with, and make sure you don't take too much risk because ultimately your stomach will panic you and cause you to sell. And so one of the great values of a good advisor is, one, making sure you got that right as best as you can and then helping you stay the course. But the last bit of data I want to give you before we wrap up and then go to questions is this one. Very similar period, only even worse. September through June 31, the market dropped 30%. But that was only the beginning because the next year was the worst 12 months we ever experienced. We were down 67%.
What time frame are we talking about, Larry?
This is July 31 through June 32.
What year?
31 through 32.
Thank you.
And so the whole period from September 29 through June 32, the market's down 83%. But in the last 12 months, it's down 67. An absolute disaster, far worse than anything we've experienced. So most people by then have hit what I call their GMO point. They can't take it anymore. Their stomach screams, get me out, and they've sold. Few hearty souls like Warren Buffett who say the time to get greedy is when everyone else is panicking, maybe are buying there. But most people are panicked and they're out. They say, Larry, I'm just going to get out until we get clarity. Maybe they set a rule. I'll get back in after the market goes up 2 months. Okay? So let's say that's your rule because you have to have some way to know when to go back in. July and August of 32, the market's up 90%. So Irv now decides, okay, it's safe to get back in. He's now missed this 90% move up, however. So he invests. The next 6 months, the market drops 30%. Irv says, uh-oh, false alarm. The sharks are still in the water. Better get out again. And the next 4 months, the market's up 61%. Now, during that 12-month period, the market went up 163%, and Irv lost 30% more on top of the 83 he lost in the first place. That is why there's only, in my mind, two investment strategies. One is have an asset allocation plan you can live with, and let's say, for argument's sake, it was 50-50. If you made a mistake and took too much risk and you can't stomach it, find the right one, run a Monte Carlo simulation, work with Irv, and maybe you can, you know, still reach your goals at 50%. And if that's you learned that lesson, that's fine. It's a mistake you made, but we all make mistakes. You don't want to repeat the mistake because the market could go a lot lower. That's certainly a risk. That's okay. It's a sunk cost, and you have to admit it costs you money, but it's better than repeating the mistake. The other strategy that's okay is go to cash. And nothing in between makes any sense. Now, if you go to cash and stay there, you're dooming your portfolio to negative returns after taxes and inflation because you're taking no risk. And not many people can make their financial goals doing so. Okay? The worst strategy is to jump in and out, as I just showed you, because you can easily get whipsawed, and you don't even have to look to that period I just gave you. November 20th, the market bottomed out, and you sell. 6 weeks later, the market, or 5 weeks, whatever the time frame was, the market went up. Some indices were up 25%. So you get back in, and now you're down another 20%. There's no way once you do that to be able to buy stocks again. You'll never know, and you're doomed to fail. That's what all the evidence shows. So the key is get that asset allocation right. If you made a mistake and took too much risk, lower it, but then stick with that new one and don't say, well, I'll just go back to 50-50 again. I'll go to 40-60 now. And when things are better, I'll go back to 50-50 because you can easily get whipsawed. So I want to just conclude with a comment because I think most people have a high regard for Warren Buffett. Leave you to what he says about market timing. He said this. We've long felt that the only value of stock forecasters is to make fortune tellers look good. Even now, Charlie Munger and I continue to believe that short-term market forecasts are poison and should be kept locked up in a safe place away from children and also from grown-ups who behave in the market like children. So the winning strategy is simple. Just do what I suggested. Have a well-thought-out plan. Anticipate these risks. As I said, this is the third really severe bear market since 73, so it should not have been unexpected except in its timing. And then make sure you stay the course. And Irv will take questions now.
Okay. Thanks, Larry. That was absolutely great. And I wanted to, you know, add something from one of your books, and I don't remember which one. Apologize for that. But I think somewhere you said that, you know, you can have a very bad plan but have a very lucky outcome, or you can have a very, you know, good plan and have a bad outcome. You know, you do the bad planning based on most of the information that you have, but, you know, you can't expect what result you're necessarily going to get.
Exactly. The perfect example is a young man, a wife and two kids, and he doesn't buy life insurance, even though if he dies early, his family would be left destitute. He doesn't die. Lousy strategy, lucky outcome. But you can also have a good, well-thought-out plan, and then really bad things happen, doesn't mean the plan was bad.
So I'm going to ask you one or two questions that have been fed to us by our clients already, and then those of you that are on the line would like to ask some questions. We'll give you the opportunity to do that. You know, you said in your presentation, Larry, that in the long run, the expected return on bonds has got to be higher than the expected return on equities, or the capital system would sort of grind to a halt.
The other way around, the expected return on stocks.
On equities is got to be higher than bonds. Thank you. You know, or our capital system, as we know it, would grind to a halt. And there's been some discussion about the fact that this data is all based on, you know, the data that we're talking about or using has been based on the American market, the U.S. market, over the last 80 years, and perhaps it's not a broad enough view, you know, of the world given, you know, this global economic situation. Is there any comment you would have?
It gets right to the heart of the matter that we just talked about, that stocks must be risky or they would not have the higher returns. It just means the risks show up. Now, I think the mistake that people make is partly, and unfortunately, an otherwise good book called Stocks for the Long Run by Jeremy Siegel. People took the wrong message from that book, and I think it was his fault in the way he wrote it, but that stocks aren't risky. Just look at the U.S. If you just wait long enough, you'll get rewarded. But that's not necessarily true. That's one bit of history. You can look at other countries where that has not been true. But that doesn't change the fact that stocks have higher expected returns. What it means is sometimes the risk will show up. And if that wasn't true, that the risk never showed up, then, like we said, stock prices would get bid up to levels so they'd have the same returns as stocks. The key is you must accept the fact that that risk is always there. And we can have stocks drop 70 or 80%. It's no different. Then, you know, let me say it this way. Everybody gets that understanding if you talk about bonds. So a good example would be, let's say U.S. 10-year bonds are 3%, and let's say GM bonds for 10 years are 15%. Okay? Now, does that mean as a guarantee that GM bonds are going to outperform Treasuries? No. There's a risk of default. That's exactly why the yield is 15%. Well, the same thing is true of stocks. They must have a higher expected return, but that's just it. The key is expected, and it's related to the amount of risk. Stocks are risky, and you need to make sure you understand that, incorporate it into your plan, because if you don't, the risk inevitably will show up, and you will panic and sell. So you must have enough safe fixed income in your portfolio to dampen the overall risk to a level you can live with.
If you were talking about that just from a liquidity point of view, you know, would you have a view that somebody, you know, particularly in a withdrawal phase, ought to have, you know, a year's worth of that kind of liquidity or 2 years? Is there some, you know, sort
of... I don't really look at it that way because all of the assets that we buy on the fixed income side are highly liquid and can be sold so you can raise liquidity.
Yeah.
Obviously, you want to have some kind of laddered type of portfolio so you have you don't use a 20-year bond to fund the one-year expenses because the bond price could be too volatile. So you want to match to some degree your expenses in that way. But the more important thing is to look at the amount of risk in the portfolio relative to the amount of risk you need to take to meet your goals. So too many times people make the mistake of isolating the asset allocation decision to some dumb rule like 100 minus your age. It really is a combination of what we call the ability, willingness, and need to take risk, and that's where a good advisor adds lots of value by evaluating those things. But what I tell people is this, a mistake that lots of high net worth people make is the following. They have the ability to take risk because they're very high net worth. They may have the willingness to take it, but they have very little need to take risk. And therefore, if they recognize that, and I'll just use an example, if you have $10 million a year, you can safely spend, you know, almost, you know, regardless of your equity allocation, say $400,000 a year, unless the world blows up and we have a market like this. But if you're only spending $100,000 or $200,000 a year, why do you want to sit with a high equity allocation? And so I often spend a lot of time talking people down to much lower equity allocations because I point out the risk can show up, and life's too short not to enjoy it. You've earned it. Go sleep well, because the good thing is if the markets were to go way up and you turn 10 into 20 million, it's not going to change your life in any meaningful way. Probably won't even change your kids' life in any meaningful way. But if you get this kind of market and you lose 50, 60% of your money, then it can change life in many very meaningful ways. And I unfortunately see people, I just met with one yesterday, high net worth person, who had a big business risk. His business is highly cyclical, and he was 100% equities. He says, you know, I'm a big boy. I can take it. Very, got a strong stomach. Well, now he's changed his mind.
Okay, thank you. I think with that, we want to make sure if there's some questions out there, people get a chance to ask them. So if you have a question you have not sent into us by email, please hit *6 on your phone to unmute your phone and go ahead and ask your question. We got any other questions out there? In the meantime, I'll ask you one more, Larry, while we're waiting for that. The other comment I keep hearing, and of course you've addressed this a bit, but I wonder if we could touch it again, and that is that, you know, all this tremendous amount of debt that we're creating in this country, you know, all of this leverage, all of these stimulus packages and bailouts, et cetera, you know, how is that going to affect us in the long run in terms of paying that back? How is inevitably mm-hmm. is our economy going to survive that kind of huge, you know, multi-trillion dollar deficit every year?
Right. What you have to look at is not the size of the numbers themselves, but you have to look at them as size relative to the GNP. I think we can agree, Irv, we came out of World War II and had a great economic history after that. Stock returns were, you know, spectacular, and the economy did very well. And we had a far, far, far higher debt to GNP than we will have 2, 3, 5 years after this event. We're nowhere near the kinds of levels that we saw then. The key will be, will we start to cut the spending down as the economy recovers and start to, you know, and allow the GNP to grow and revenues generate to keep up so that it's sustainable. You can't have, in the long term, the kinds of deficits we're having. You will end up printing money and just inflating it away, which is what Germany did. So ultimately, we have to cut back in spending, and that's going to be the question, you know, we will face, you know, 2, 3, 4 years down the road. But it's certainly with the U.S. GNP to debt ratio is only about 40%. Most of the industrial world is higher than that, and I told you Japan is at 180%, I think. So we've got plenty of room to deal with this issue, but there's no question we need to address it and prevent these budgets from being permanently of this size.
Thank you. Anybody out there with a question that they want to ask or they're willing to risk asking? Okay, one more then here while we just see if that happens. Another question from one of our clients that was emailed in is many people are, or economists are predicting what they call an L-shaped recovery. I wonder if you would take just one moment, Larry, and explain what an L-shaped recovery is and
right.
then what you think, how do you think that might make a difference?
Right. Most of the recessions in the past have been what are called V-shapes, and that had to do with a great deal of the fact that we were a very heavily manufacturing-oriented economy, and the economy would go into recessions because the economy would slow down and businesses would immediately have this oversupply of, you know, of goods, hanging inventories would go way up. So they'd shut down, automobile plants would shut down and everything, and the economy would take a dive. Then eventually the stimulus programs would come in, and then, boom, the economy's recovering, and now all of a sudden the factories don't have the capacity, so they ramp up, and we'd have these V-shaped recoveries. Now, the last kinds of recessions have not been that kind of way. We didn't have the depth of the recession in 2001 as our economy has become more service-oriented. as well. So you would think more of a U-shaped recovery and a U-shaped type of recession. This L-shape is what some economists are forecasting because the size of the losses, the damages, estimated we've lost $15 trillion in total value between houses and the stock market, is so much, is so great that we just can't recover because where's the resources to do so? I can only comment on this. One, as I started out, there are no economic forecasters who really can forecast. For those of you who are interested in the subject, I would urge you to read a wonderful book by William Sherden called The Fortune Sellers, which is sort of a review of the history of economic forecasting and shows there are no good forecasters. Even the people who can control or influence the economy, like the Fed, have horrible track records, and therefore you really should ignore them. This is just stuff for entertainment on CNBC, and unfortunately it causes people to emotions to get stirred, and then they make bad investment decisions. I could give you a forecast, but I would tell you it would be as worthless as the ones you hear on TV. I don't know any more than anyone else. Like I said, there's one person who knows, and I don't get to talk to him. So is it a possibility of a flat recovery where we'll be in a very low level of economic activity for a long time? Yes. But even that doesn't tell you what the stock market will do. Let me conclude with this, Irv, unless we have other questions. We are in a great crisis. There is no question about that. But the magnitude of the efforts to come out of it are great, and we're going to see more. I have a great faith in this country, in our capitalist system, in the democracy. We've come out of, I could list 10 other very serious crises just since World War II, forget the Great Depression, and we've come out of every one of them. The problem is people forget that. Just the RTC crisis when we lost about 2,000 banks, no one's forecasting anything like that. We've lost something like 20 so far, and people forget that. And they need to keep their heads. Now, if you have no faith in the capitalist system, go to cash and stay there. But I'm not in that camp.
I think probably neither are we. Larry, thank you so much. Any other questions? One last opportunity. Okay, we're going to end the phone call. Thank you all for listening in and participating in it. I'm sure that you found this information helpful and enlightening. Larry, thank you once again for your time and effort.
My pleasure.
In doing this for us. And goodbye, everybody. Have a great day.